I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Several dozen House Republicans barged into a closed-door deposition being held by three House committees yesterday, demanding that they be allowed to witness testimony that's part of the impeachment probe. Bear in mind that there are Republicans who are members of those committees. There was shouting and pizza, and after 5 hours they left, and Deputy Assistant Defense Secretary Laura Cooper gave her testimony. She's just the latest in a number of diplomats who've been called to testify about the administration's actions regarding Ukraine. On Tuesday, the country's top Ukrainian diplomat, Ambassador William Taylor's explosive opening statement was made public as he testified, complaining that the White House was running a shadow foreign policy headed up by the president's personal attorney, Rudolph Giuliani, circumventing the career diplomats, including himself. He detailed a campaign to pressure the new Ukrainian president to announce an investigation into the Bidens and the 2016 presidential campaign, and using hundreds of millions in aid as a cudgel, as a quid pro quo, if you will. Well, today on Radio Times, what this says about foreign policy and about impeachment. We have three guests, two of whom join us here in our Philadelphia studios. Claire Finkelstein teaches national security law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. She's also director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at the University of Pennsylvania. And Claire, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're very welcome. Also with us is John Gans. He's a former Pentagon speechwriter. He's also director of communications and research at the University of Pennsylvania's Perry World House. His new book is called White House Warriors, How the National Security Council Transformed the American Way of War. John Gans, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me on.
You're very welcome. And joining us from Duke University is Bruce Jettelson. He's a professor of public policy and political science at Duke, also served in the State Department in the Obama administration, and he's got a book called The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from the 20th Century Statesmanship. And Bruce Jettelson, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
We have a lot to talk about. Claire, let me begin with you and just your overall response to Ambassador Taylor's testimony. There was a lot there to discuss, but your overall takeaway. Is this the kind of smoking gun that Democrats are referring to?
It really was, and he is the star witness thus far of these hearings. His testimony was incredibly detailed, at least from what we know of the opening statement. It provided very clear evidence of the existence of the quid pro quo, which the administration had been denying. It suggested that President Zelensky felt tremendous pressure from the Trump administration, and even before he became president, so it seems several months before. Though he may not have been aware from the very beginning that the military aid was being held up, the pressure then was increased with the announcement of the withholding of the military aid. And it made very clear that he was expected to make a public announcement.
On CNN, apparently.
That he was investigating the firm that Hunter Biden worked for. So that kind of manipulation of Ukrainian politics and the demand that the Ukrainian president respond on cue was really very clearly laid out in the testimony.
Bruce, Jettelson, sorry about that. I'd be curious about your overall response to Taylor's testimony.
Yeah, I agree with what Claire said in terms of the level of detail. None of the other witnesses had as long a chronology. Smoking gun, but probably smoking guns plural here. And he added really two particular things. One was he contexted this reminding us about how important the Ukraine issue is. You know, he had been ambassador there in the Bush administration. He reminded us that they are at war with Russia, that efforts to try to help them make the transition from communism go back a quarter century across many administrations. And you had a sense when you, and I'm sure it was there in the room, of how deeply committed he was as a career diplomat, you know, to the United States interest as well as values at stake here. And the other thing, as a career diplomat, I've worked with Bill Taylor and I know him, and, you know, 50 years of service in Afghanistan and Iraq and Israel-Palestine, very straight-up guy. For the Trump White House to respond by trying to call him a radical or a never-Trumper, the only thing Bill Taylor's a never is never be unprofessional and not serve your country.
Well, and it should be said that Ukraine is one of our allies. And there was a point, Bruce, in the testimony that was released by Ambassador Taylor where he worried by withholding money from Ukraine that Ukrainian people, some people could die, not to be overly dramatic here, but he said it.
No, he talked about being out on the bridge and looking at people in a very graphic way, and knowing that if the supplies and support didn't reach them, they were more endangered. And again, when we read that on the page, it strikes us like you just said. But imagine what that was like in the room for him to depict that. I think it was very powerful.
John, let me get you in on the conversation. You have an interesting book that looks at the National Security Council, also looking at some of these career diplomats. And some have said this is the deep state fighting back. Some of people have said this is the state fighting back. When you look at the series of career diplomats who have been testifying before these House committees, what's your takeaway?
Well, I think that the most important thing that I sort of took away from the testimony was that Bill Taylor and thousands of other diplomats, military officers, really millions, have spent the better part of 70 years building up the United States as a global leader who is looked to for not only help when you were desperate, not only for sort of engagement, but also for hope, right? And for people who are in tough situations, the United States has represented that. And that's an image that has been built, but it's also been done through a series of policy decisions and processes that have been put in place over the last 70 years. And what you see is that Bill Taylor basically makes a distinction between the regular order of how government is supposed to work and how regular policy is supposed to be made and what is a radical sort of departure, this sort of what he calls an irregular process. And what he sort of talks about is sort of this rogue operation that was being done to put pressure.
And is that highly unusual?
I think it is rare in the history of the United States government to have a policy process that's being run completely distinct. That's one of the reasons we have the National Security Council and the national security process that was established 70 years ago. And I think that's why there is this running tension between the way government has worked and a president who has no government experience. And I think what we've seen in this particular instance is that Donald Trump has really not figured out how to make the regular government work and has instead, and especially in this situation, appears to have sort of gone around the government in a means to sort of pursue his own objectives.
Claire, let me go back to you. And Taylor and others are not the only ones. It really began with the whistleblower. We obviously don't know who he or she is. But the president's response is to call these people or to allege that these people are spies. He called the former ambassador to Ukraine a bad person. He has called some of these people scum. What is the impact of that? And how unprecedented is that?
Well, it's completely unprecedented. Whatever political differences we've had in this country in the past, we really have never had this kind of mudslinging to this degree and the use of obscenities and really crude addresses in political life. Of course, people are afraid and people have been afraid to come forward. I think what's happening now is that the dam is starting to burst. When you have someone like Bill Taylor who's willing to come forward, who's still in the administration, right? Still
he's back in
for
Ukraine,
the,
as I understand.
State
it.
Department is a really extraordinary thing because normally you don't see that kind of resistance cropping up from individuals who are currently in the administration. So I think the tide is starting to turn and people are starting to have some courage with regard to stepping up and also the degree to which they are appalled. I mean, Bill Taylor made very clear in his statement that he had dedicated his life in part to supporting Ukraine against the Russians. And this reversal of policy on the part of the United States is obviously he regarded as deeply dismaying.
Let me play a clip, and this is actually an edited clip of White House Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. He's at a White House press conference last Thursday, so a week ago, and he is responding to a reporter's question. Let me just play that.
But to be clear, what you just described is a quid pro quo. It is funding will not flow unless the investigation into the Democratic server happened as well.
We do that all the time with foreign policy. We were holding up money at the same time for, what was it, the Northern Triangle countries. And I have news for everybody. Get over it. There's going to be political influence in foreign policy. I'm talking to Mr. Carl.
Let me get your response to that, Bruce. And as I said, that's a week old, but it still has resonance today.
Yeah, I have to say that get over it comment for all the comments we've heard from the Trump administration the last, almost 3 years, that one was really chilling.
Yeah.
It really goes with this notion, as Claire was talking before, that, you know, as I said to a journalist the other day, I've had many presidents I disagreed with, but never one that I thought was truly dangerous to the country and the world. And he's not just inexperienced in the presidency. He's trying to make the presidency, he's shaping it to himself rather than to learn the presidency. And the notion that Mulvaney said about the Northern Triangle,
right.
Sure, some foreign aid is political in the sense that we have interests, but there's a difference between the national interests that you're pressuring for and the personal political interests that were going on with Ukraine.
You say he's dangerous. Our president is dangerous. Are we talking that he is now in? Well, he's, you know, obviously the House is looking into impeachment. But from what you have observed, Bruce, is he impeachable?
You know, I'm not a lawyer, but you can see the trend on this. I guess my comment was really more that if he were to be impeached tomorrow or defeated in 2020, the legacy of what he has done to sort of the guardrails and the norms and the common practices of our system, they're still going to be with us. It's almost like if the next president lied 20% of the time, we'd think it was an improvement. And so the damage to the system, separate from the specific policies for a democracy, is really the thing that is deeply, deeply troubling for all of us.
Well, Claire is a lawyer. Go ahead, Claire.
Well, first of all, let's note that when Mulvaney says get over it, he's talking about crimes. Right. So he's not saying, well, this is just a different kind of diplomacy. Let's get over it and recognize the new reality. We're talking about conspiracy to commit campaign finance violations. We're talking about extortion, potentially bribery. Right. So obstruction of justice than in other contexts. So I don't think we can just get over that. And I think that that is what the House is grappling with. The House almost certainly will impeach him. And it's possible that he will then be convicted in the Senate because we need presumably about 20 Republican senators, assuming that all the Democrats vote for impeachment and the two independents do. And 20, given the opposition that we're starting to hear from Republican senators, that's a possibility. We could end up with 20.
John, we're almost having a break here, but just I'd be curious about your response.
Yeah, I think that the idea that there is some effort to sort of push for some interest when we're making these deals is not foreign. And I don't think Americans are across the board. But I think most Americans do know that the president's personal reelection is not what should be used as the national interest, right? And that is a very clear line. That is one that, you know, and one benefit of the Mueller investigation is that it has educated the public on how disappointing and how potentially illegal foreign interference in election is. So I think that generally speaking, he is misrepresenting foreign policy, and he's also misrepresenting what was done here with Ukraine.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. That's John Ganz, also with us, Claire Finkelstein. She's with us, or both of them with us, in our Philadelphia studio, and Bruce Gentleson. He's joining us from Duke University. You can join us. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us 1-888-477-9499.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with our guests about a whole bunch of stuff, including U.S. Ambassador William Taylor's damning testimony earlier this week, how it could impact the impeachment probe, what it says about U.S. foreign policy, and the White House response. And again, our guests are Claire Finkelstein. She teaches national security law at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at Penn. John Ganz is a former Pentagon speechwriter, director of communications and research at the University of Pennsylvania's Perry World House. His new book is called White House Warriors. And joining us from the studios of Duke University, Bruce Gentleson, professor of public policy and political science at Duke University. He served in the State Department in the Obama administration and is the author of The Peacemakers, Leadership Lessons from the 20th Century Statesmanship. Claire, you wanted to say something. We've been talking sort of off the air about what was discussed in a circuit court discussion about the president and his authority.
Right. Well, what's really at issue here is executive authority. What is the scope of executive authority? And since 9/11, we've seen a steady expansion in the understanding of executive authority. And here we had, in the fight over whether or not the president has to turn over his tax returns, the president's lawyer yesterday actually arguing that there is nothing that can be done to a sitting president, that a sitting president is immune even to investigation, and that if he were to take a handgun and start shooting people on Fifth Avenue, that the police could not arrest him, stop him, or investigate him if they found out about it later.
Is there any court precedent on this one
way
or the
other?
There is
no precedent at all. And what's really happened is that the expanded conception of the president as commander-in-chief, as having total control over war, has now expanded into thinking that that same kind of privilege exists outside the context of war. And there's just no basis for that.
John, is that where impeachment comes in, though?
Yeah, I mean, I think if the argument that the court of law, and I think this is part of what sort of shaped the Robert Mueller's conclusions, which is there are recourses, but they aren't typically legal or criminal. They're congressional, which is impeachment proceedings. I think the challenge that the impeachment proceedings are going to have is that, you know, they're going to have to crack open the presidency. If these crimes happened, they clearly came from the top, and they clearly came from the office of the president. And to understand a illegal foreign policy operation, you're going to have to open up the White House, the National Security Council, and other things. And that is where this conflict will eventually go. It will be a fight over the power of the executive and executive privilege and those things.
But doesn't that freight impeachment too much? I mean, the fact that the president is conceived now as being so far above the law that you couldn't even stop him if you caught him in flagrant delicto, engaged in a crime, puts too much pressure on the political solution here.
Well, Bruce, I'm sure there's something you want to add to our conversation. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think what's been interesting about this, too, is where the tide turned on the momentum on impeachment. And it really did with these national security issues. And so you had the seven first-term Democratic members, all of whom had national security experience. In fact, I'm sure John worked with Alyssa Slotkin, the congresswoman from Michigan, and in fact, five of whom were women, who, you know, came from districts that they had beaten that were typically Trump areas, and this really brought them out for impeachment. It changed Speaker Pelosi's calculation, and what we've seen is Republicans, you know, tiny bits, toes in the water on national security issues. If you go back to the brutal murder of Jamal Khashoggi, little bit of outspokenness among Republicans. And now on this, because Republicans are torn between their traditional identity as hawks who take security seriously and their fear of Donald Trump, you know, sort of challenging them in primaries. So the notion of getting some votes in the Senate, or frankly, if you're a Democratic strategist, putting some senators who have tough races in 2020 up again to make them make a big choice, there are a lot of things pointing there, both national security and political, that are all pointing in the direction now of going ahead with impeachment.
Well, it's interesting, Bruce, that a number of Republicans very publicly critical about what President Trump did regarding the Kurds and Syria. That seemed to be a bridge too far for a number of Republicans.
That's right. And it fits in this pattern of you know, national security issues, Saudi Arabia, Ukraine. And the way he did, you know, there's plenty of debate. I was involved in the debates when I was in the Obama administration about what to do in Syria. But the way he did it, it was just so extraordinary. And it's been interesting because the polling shows, very surprisingly, that Trump's sleight of hand has made Republican voters actually not see Vladimir Putin as a threat. And that worries some of these members because they think that's where voters should be. And it's part of their base. So national security, and then the role, as people said before, of our career diplomats and career intelligence officers coming forward out of patriotism, not deep state, but out of patriotism, it's really quite powerful. And that part is, you know, it's pleasing, I guess, for us amidst all the other difficulties we see.
John, you wanted to add something to
that? Yeah, I think what you're seeing here is that Ukraine begets Syria. You know, this is a massive corruption of the foreign policy enterprise of the United States, which is in many ways a bipartisan project, and to a degree one that has strong support from Republicans, Democrats, and across the country. And I think that what people are seeing is a worrying sign of this corruption. This phone call is, I think, just with Ukraine is just one, I think, useful example that has been exposed. But my hunch, and I think Syria demonstrates this, is this corruption and this inability to sort of divorce the national interest from one's personal interest, the inability to sort of focus on a regular order and listen to the experts, has led to a series of bad decisions. Ukraine is a good example of that, one that might actually get him impeached. Syria is a good example of that, one that's gotten a lot of people killed and has set America's interest back in the region. And so one suspects that's happening elsewhere. And one of the problems with national security is that so much of it is blocked from public view that we
that's
don't
right.
know what
that's
other
right.
deals have been made. And so my hunch is the only way to really get at the problem will be to expose all of this through these kind of hearings. And Bill Taylor did a good example of just describing one messy situation. But just imagine this is happening everywhere.
I know you want to say something, Claire, but let me read just one or two comments here that we've got. Dave emailed us right at the top. How is what is now being called shadow foreign policy any different from common back channel communication, which I think is a fair question? And Donald said, when Joe Biden was vice president, he threatened to withhold aid if Ukraine did not remove their attorney general. Could your guests comment on whether they view that differently from what President Trump did? Can I toss that to you, Claire?
Yeah, I think there is one very important difference, just to answer the second question. Because what's going on here is meant to benefit the president personally. It's not a matter of holding up aid because he believes he's doing something that works to the benefit of the United States. He's trying to get reelected, and he's trying to get Ukraine to dig up dirt on his political adversary. Now, the only way in which it might be similar is that one wonders whether or not Trump was already under pressure from Vladimir Putin to withhold this aid. And in this way, the Ukraine situation is fairly similar to what's going on in Syria. Because who is the big winner in all this? It's always Vladimir Putin. So there's personal corruption, but there's also knuckling under to our political adversaries. And that's where the Republican senators start to get off the boat.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Bruce, and do all roads lead to Vladimir Putin when we're talking about our president?
You know, they sure seem to. But I think that even if that's not true, we're seeing, you know, your person who sent in the message asked about back channel.
Yeah.
And when Henry Kissinger, you know, went in 1971 to have back channel talks with Chou En-lai, it was to promote the interests of the United States. And when Barack Obama sent his top diplomats to Oman to have quiet back-channel talks with Iran, it was to what he believed was promoting the interest of the United States. This is so different. This is like, make a deal that helps me politically, pure and simple. And moreover, the irony, I think, of this is, you know, Trump still somehow has this need to prove things about the 2016 election, which was over. And he's doing things against Joe Biden at a point in which Biden may or may not be the Democratic candidate, but it shows how this narcissism and this it's all about me is just the principal driver for pretty much everything that Donald Trump does.
John, let me toss something to you, sort of deep state related, sure. But this is Stephanie Grisham, the White House press secretary, saying in a statement, President Trump has done nothing wrong. This is a coordinated smear campaign from far left lawmakers and radical unelected bureaucrats waging a war on the Constitution. That unelected bureaucrats, I think, is kind of, Washington speak
code
for the deep state. And I just want to throw John Bolton in this as well. He was head of the National Security Council, quit, fired, not sure. But he shows up in Taylor's testimony I think has some important things to tell us.
Well, it's two things I'd say about it. One, the sort of fight over the sort of so-called deep state preceded Donald Trump into office. This is a piece of the sort of current past 18 years of sort of post 9/11 wars discussion, which is, you know, many on the left thought there was a deep state pushing us into war from the foreign policy community, the national security establishment. And that was, a lot of books were written about that before during the Obama administration. Mm-hmm. Then the Trump administration comes in and Trump has, I think, to a degree, met a lot of bureaucratic resistance, as a lot of presidents do, and has sort of his supporters on the right have sort of adopted the term deep state.
Right.
And for a while, the president actually resisted it. He said, I don't like the term, but has sort of grabbed hold of it, I think, as a means of political survival. And this isn't, you know, the United States, as I always try to tell people, especially when I go out and talk about my book, is that there isn't a deep state. If there was a deep state, government would be a lot easier.
We wouldn't be talking about
it. We wouldn't be talking
stuff,
about it.
Right.
This deal would all got sorted behind the scenes. But what I think you find here is that there is naturally some level of bureaucratic resistance to a president. Every president, the ones I worked for, the one Bruce worked for, you know, this is what you deal with. But I think one of the things you find is that people like John Bolton are supposed to help the president figure out how to work government.
Yes.
And right. Bruce and we can talk about this, but I think that John Bolton struggled to do that, struggled to get Donald Trump to work in government. But also John Bolton decided that maybe government wasn't the best way to get his own views across, and dissembled and disassembled much of the national security process that is meant to bring the bureaucracy and the military together with the president to find a solution. And what has happened is by dismantling that, by sort of getting rid of the National Security Council and minimizing its importance, Donald Trump has really been unleashed.
And because of Bolton?
Because in part what the decisions Bolton made while he was National Security Advisor.
Bruce, sounds like you wanted to add something. And Clara does as well. Go ahead, Bruce.
Sure. Not on Bolton, but on a couple of things that John was saying. I mean, the whole deep state thing, actually, the first time that we were really using that term was in Egypt. You know, when there was the Arab Spring and there was this resistance inside. And it's interesting that we, rather than take our political system to help the Middle East, somehow we're taking their sense back into the United States. Sure. And they use it everywhere. It's the economists in the Department of Agriculture who talks about climate change damage, you know, to agriculture, or somebody in the EPA or somebody in the Interior. And so I think it's one of those things that maybe you can caricaturize some people. He caricaturizes Nancy Pelosi unfairly, but maybe it's effective. But when you start doing it as the Bill Taylors and the economists, most people, other than the, you know, the total Trump base, are going to say, you know, I don't think so. You're pressing this a little too far.
And that's Bruce Gentleson joining us along with John Gans and Claire Finkelstein. And we are talking about a bunch of different things related to the Trump administration, related to what we are learning about what the Trump administration tried to do in Ukraine, and some of the testimony that we have heard, including the testimony this week from U.S. Ambassador William Taylor. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes, and you can give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Claire, you've been very patient. Go ahead. I know you want to say something.
Well, I just wanted to say on the comment about deep state, it's really extraordinary that this president has the ability to say something, oh, there's a deep state, and that people in massive numbers believe him. And that's really a puzzle that I think commentators and theorists will be worrying about for a very long time. How is it that yesterday, when he makes the announcement, this has been a total victory in Syria? This is a terrific outcome, and people have been congratulating me, when in fact anyone who knows anything about the situation knows that it's a deep disaster for the region as well as for the United States. But yet I'm guessing that if there were a poll taken today about how many people think that it's a great success and a wonderful outcome in Syria, that many people would say, yeah, only because the president said it. Now, when does the reality principle kick in, and when do people start to really understand what's going on here?
But is that why Taylor's testimony is so important, in that you've got this, 50-year career diplomat who seems rather unblemished for a 72-year-old man?
Well, that's right. And certainly, again, among people who understand anything about the situation, understand how important that testimony was, and among other things, for identifying the impact and involvement of Giuliani here. But when you have large numbers of Republican members of the House then staging this invasion and this attack and saying, these are a secret proceedings and we're being kept out of them and this is outrageous and it's a lynching, people believe that. Hmm. Now, why is that? Why does it have that much power?
Kate says the Republican criticism that these impeachment inquiries shouldn't be happening behind closed doors is ridiculous. This is how all these inquiries start out. But nonetheless, it seems to me at some point the Democrats are going to have to bring this stuff out in the open, John.
Well, I think one of the reasons, and if Donald Trump has a sort of perverse genius, it's that he does tap into sort of deep-rooted fears and feelings. And Bruce isn't with us here, but we're not far from Independence Hall, right, where the United States – the term far deep state might have been ripped out of the Middle East, but the fear of an unaccountable power is one that goes deep into America's psyche. And my hunch, and I think one of the challenges with the inquiry, is that so far how it's been going is with leaks and occasional testimonies that have come about.
True.
And I think that has been helpful for the cause of setting the foundation for this inquiry. But I think one of the challenges that Democrats and those that want to hold the president accountable for what has happened will face is that at the end of the day, the United States, many of the American people don't really understand how foreign policy is made. It is something that has benefited most of Washington to keep it deeply held secrets and behind closed doors. And the only way you're going to be able to really demonstrate how corrupted it has become is if you expose the process to people. And I think one of the things I write about in the book is there's few more deep-seated risks to the security of the United States than undermining the belief in an accountable government and a representative government. And so what I think they're going to have to do is you're going to actually have to sort of show some evidence. And this is not going to happen in closed-doors hearings. That's not how you convince more than your 48, 49, 50, 51% of the people to not only impeach but convict. And I think that you're going to have to bring real evidence.
Yep.
You're
going
to have to – it can't just be a bunch of bureaucrats.
Yep.
I think everybody's saying it's the revenge of the deep state now, but it's not going to be enough. And I think the other thing we're going to find is there are plenty of bureaucrats and government employees that went along with this. And I think that maybe not enough. Maybe they weren't the majority. But Donald Trump wasn't acting alone, and it wasn't just Rudy Giuliani. And I think there's fine-standing people like Bill Taylor, but this is a messier story and one that is going to have to be exposed in a very sort of grueling, heartbreaking, and to a degree costly for the United States process, because it's going to distract our foreign policy enterprise at a time we should be focusing on other things.
Bruce, I'd love to hear from you. We're almost up in a break, but go ahead. And if you can't finish, we'll pick up after the break.
Sure. Just real quick. I mean, I think those hearings that are being held, the Republicans who crashed the hearings made it look like it was just Democrats. And, you know, as was said in the NPR News report, there were Republicans on the committee. It just happened these weren't members. I think the strategy now is to make it as comfortable as possible for people to give the information to Adam Schiff's committee and the others. And then you do start to go public with it. We've already seen dramatic shifts in the polling favoring impeachment. And if you go back to the Watergate period, it was really slow to get there. But when it got there, it was, you know, because things had accumulated. So I actually think they've got a strategy here, and they know they have to go public. But many people would not have testified at this point if it was straight public right now.
Well, let's take that short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking with Bruce Gentleson, John Ganz, and Claire Finkelstein about U.S. foreign policy, about impeachment, about Ukraine, also about Ambassador Taylor's testimony and what it all means. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe, talking with Claire Finkelstein. Again, she teaches national security law at University of Pennsylvania Law School, director of the Center for Ethics and the Rule of Law at Penn. John Ganz, former Pentagon speechwriter, director of communications and research at the University of Pennsylvania's Perry World House. His book is called White House Warriors. Bruce Gentleson, joining us from Duke University, professor of public policy and political science at Duke. He served in the State Department in the Obama administration, and he's got a book called The Peacemakers. Let me play a clip of Senator Lindsey Graham being interviewed on HBO's Axios on Sunday. Here he is talking to Jonathan Swan.
Are you open-minded if more comes out that you could support impeachment?
Sure. Show me something that is a crime. If you could show me that, you know, Trump actually was engaging in a quid pro quo outside the phone call, that would be very disturbing.
It's always interesting to try to read where Lindsey Graham is coming from, I should say. Claire, do you want to add anything to that?
Lindsey Graham is absolutely baffling, right? Because on the situation with Syria, he was very upset with the president and fairly outspoken about it. And then he turns around and defends the president on his executive privilege. And so it's says that it's a lynching that's going on. So it's really baffling that he switches back and forth like that. It's not his historical politics to accept what President Trump is doing. And so I think his standard opposition to the foreign policy that the president is engaging in comes out periodically and when he feels it's safe to do so because other Republicans are backing him. But so far, it doesn't look like he's really intending to make that break.
Let me read a couple of more comments. One from John. The fact that Giuliani, Trump's personal lawyer, was paid by Ukrainians shows that this has nothing to do with Hunter Biden. An email from Tom. This impeachment is a total farce. The hearings are being held in a basement skiff. Republicans are not allowed to take part. Just responding to you, Tom, there are Republicans on those committees that are part of these hearings. So Republicans, not the Republicans that stormed the door yesterday, but there are Republicans that do sit on that committee, or those committees, I should say. Comment from Kate, the Republican criticism that these impeachment inquiries shouldn't be happening behind closed. Oh, I already read that. Oh, so I think we're at an interesting kind of critical point, and I don't want to get too deep into Iran-Contra, but I know for you, John, you say there are some lessons from that particular crisis back under the Reagan administration.
Yeah, I think as I sort of argue in the piece that I wrote last week, one of the things that sort of is fascinating, having written a book about the NSC White House warriors, is a few people actually remember Iran-Contra, the details. They remember the hearings broadly, but they don't really remember what was said. And I think that's really the last time we've had a demonstration and a scandal over the corruption of foreign policy, which, you know, is a testament to the sort of how solid the United States foreign policy enterprise has been. You know, 30, 40 years is a long time to go.
Yep.
But what you sort of see here is a similar sort of scheme that was run off the books from the White House and to a degree counter what looks to be counter to the law. And so Iran-Contra is actually a useful thing to sort of look at. And in the piece, I say Donald Trump looks a lot less like former presidents and a lot more like Oliver North, sort of spearheading this campaign from the White House. And I think what you sort of learn from that is that two things have to sort of happen, which is that, as I've said previously, you really will have to open up the whole system. You know, the Iran-Contra investigations, which included congressional criminal inquiries and the president's own review board, ended up producing 50,000 pages of documents, right? Yeah. So far from this hearing crew, I think we have 21 pages so far. Maybe if you count Bill Taylor's testimony, it's 36. And so what I sort of argue is that unfortunately you're going to have to open this up. And the thing I sort of have argued and mentioned in the piece is that's going to really expose a lot of people, a lot of public servants to sort of the tumult of politics that is very rare, that they tend to avoid, that they sort of go into government to sort of serve in non-political context. And that has real costs. I mean, I spoke in the book and I interviewed, I spent long hours with a few of the people who are caught up in Iran-Contra. Some of them were convicted. Some of them were pardoned. But one of them was innocent and found innocent. But he still showed up in the New York Times as being blamed for the whole affair. And he ended up having to spend $50,000 of his own money in 1986.
Which one was he?
Howard Teicher, who most people don't know.
Nope.
But he ended up – he was accused of spearheading the whole thing. And he spent $50,000 of his own money to get out of trouble, even though he had done nothing wrong. So there's going to be a lot of innocent people who are sort of mixed up in this. There's going to be a lot of churn. But unfortunately, I think that's probably the only way we're ever going to be able to get to the bottom of this. I say that because as many people want this to be a quick, cut and dry, sort of minimal, sort of focused hearing and investigation, I don't think that's actually going to be possible. Because what I think is going to happen is every time you talk to somebody, you're going to find another thread you have to pull on.
Let me toss something to you, Bruce. And this was, I think I was reading the New York Times this morning about the administration reducing or even minimizing the role of career diplomats. Something like almost half of ambassadors are political appointees who have given money. That's not entirely unusual. I know that other presidents have done that. I'm not sure as many ambassadors coming as political appointees, reducing the staff of the National Security Association or Council, and that there's just a lot of tension, I guess, within the various departments related to foreign policy. Can you speak to that?
No, that's right. All presidents give ambassadorships to political donors, but the Trump percentage is higher than Obama, than Bush, than Clinton, than anybody else. And part of it is the way they're conducting their offices. There were articles the other day about the ambassador to Hungary, who threw a huge party with his own money for Viktor Orban. And embraced him And that Orban, you know, is one of those people who's not only spreading anti-Semitism, but has pushed Hungary back towards, you know, an anti-democratic system. And so we're seeing some of that. And we're generally seeing just this, you know, I don't need experts. I have the greatest brain in the world. And the people that went into the Trump administration trying to be the guardrails, you know, Jim Mattis, H.R. McMaster, you know, good professional people, found out it wasn't possible. That, you know, one difference, I think, with Iran-Contra is whereas Ronald Reagan sort of tacitly approved of the operation but really gave it neglect, and then, you know, it operated out of Ali North and this enterprise, you know, so much comes back to Donald Trump. And that, while John's right, I mean, there are a lot of issues we have to deal with in the system.
Sure.
We really haven't had as many since Nixon that emanate directly from the president himself.
John, there's even a quote I ran across where you said, no one gets impeached for foreign policy. They get impeached for lying about foreign policy.
Yeah, that's one of the pieces of advice somebody gave Howard Teicher when he was sort of dealing with this, which is, you know, foreign policy, there is a lot of leeway given to the president, right? That's the system of government we have and the system of government that's been relatively accepted by bipartisan consensus. Where Donald Trump has sort of taken that to the nth degree is that, you know, if it's about my personal interest. I think what you see here is that government has always been built to sort of allow some political influence in the sense of a president is elected. The buck stops with him. At the end of the day, he's supposed to impose some sort of will and to a degree direction on the government. But what you have sort of seen in the Trump administration, I think, is an inability to make government work in the normal way. And that starts with the National Security Council at the White House, which he has sort of fundamentally just misused since the beginning. And it has been the sort of place of crisis since the beginning, even before he really took the oath of office, and looks like it is going to be a part of this story today.
Well, Claire, I mean, I think in Watergate, Iran-Contra, and other scandals, I mean, in the end, the system did hold. People were held accountable. Yes, there were people who were dragged through the mud that probably shouldn't have been. But it is, I mean, we are in a situation where our system is being tested.
Well, I think it's hard to say that the system fully held people accountable because there was a greater tendency then for people to hold themselves accountable. Now, remember that Nixon resigned. And we have a president now who will never resign. And if you listen to Nixon's resignation speech, it really looks rather poignant and sort of almost sweet compared to today's politics, because he said, I think, with some real feeling that, you know, this is not good for the country. Obviously, he thought he had been treated unfairly, but to continue to push it, he thought, was not good for the country. Could he have continued to battle it down to the end? Yes, he could have. He might well have been impeached, but he knew that he had lost the support of Republican senators at that point. But I also think he genuinely believed this was not good for the country. Hmm. One small disagreement with something John said I wanted to raise is, yes, we can pull a lot more threads, and we would have to know everything that has gone on. But I don't think we need to know everything that has gone on to be clear that there are impeachable offenses that have been committed here. We know by the president's own admissions that he has engaged in impeachable offenses. We know from remarks he has made that he did things thinking that he was above the law when he wasn't, thinking that he had gotten rid of, you know, the problem when he fired Jim Comey, for example, and other examples of fairly clear obstruction of justice. And the more the impeachment hearings go on and the more he's put under pressure on his tax returns and from other sources, the more he does to try to obstruct the inquiry into his misdeeds. And
just adding to the number of counts of impeachment?
That's right. So obstruction of justice and all sorts of other things relating to obstructing the inquiry are very possible grounds for impeachment without necessarily knowing a lot more, though we also do have him on, I think, quite clearly on conspiracy to commit campaign finance violations, extortion, and potentially bribery.
Bruce, let me go back to you and just picking up on when we were talking about with Watergate. I mean, President Nixon resigned in part because some key Republicans went to him to put pressure on him to say, look, you know, you're hurting the country. You're probably hurting yourself. You're hurting the party. Do you see similar Republicans today?
It's interesting. You know, we're seeing, you know, tiny, tiny cracks. So the tape you played of Lindsey Graham waffling, that's a tiny, tiny crack. Mitch McConnell feeling the need to write an op-ed in the New York Times about why he feels differently about Syria and the Kurds. So, you know, these things can change. I think the Republicans are beginning, their calculation has been, you know, our political interests are sticking with him, even if it means putting party over country. And you'll have the Susan Collins in Maine and the Senator Cory Gardner in Colorado and a bunch of others who may have to change that as they think about getting reelected. But the other point I just want to make is that for all of our concentration on Donald Trump, which I totally agree with, as you know, we all said from the outset, we also have to think about, you know, the ways in which he's an effect, not just a cause. I mean, what caused Donald Trump to get elected? I'm not talking about Russian meddling.
Sure. You
know, talking about what's been going on in the country. You know, what caused Brexit to pass? And even if Hillary Clinton had won or Brexit had not passed, you know, there are real deep issues in our country that are social, economic, inequality, race, that are there to be dealt with. They're now worse because of him. But that's really, you know, very important for us to think about as we think about where we want to head in the future, that getting rid of him is absolutely crucial. But the reality is that there were forces in this country that got a guy like that elected president, and we need to really think about, and that's not just the Democratic issue, you need to think about what those are and what how to deal with them for the future of the country.
No, that's such an important point, and that's Bruce Gentleson joining us along with John Gans and Claire Finkelstein talking about America today on Radio Times, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. John, you wanted to add something.
Yeah, I think that what we're seeing, you know, you can sort of, when I heard the Lindsey Graham comments, I have a young son, and I was reminded of the game of musical chairs, where it looked like Lindsey Graham was in one of those moments where the musical chairs, where you're not sure the music's stopping, so you start sort of squatting down, trying to stay close to a chair. I think what we're finding, and I think as this sort of scandal sort of unfolds in Washington, is that there's a lot more people who are starting to worry about their own interests. And I think one of the things that history has reminded us is that presidencies under investigation and presidencies under impeachment hearings become fundamentally weaker. You know, Nixon appreciated that and knew that he had to sort of take action to sort of counter that. I think Donald Trump has struggled to understand how fundamentals of government work. And so what I think he's going to find is that the music and his ability to sort of control the music are going to be – is going to wane in the years ahead. That is where we're going to sort of start to see Washington go. But I think building on Bruce's point – this Trumpism is still a virulent strain of our political life. And so that just getting rid of Donald Trump isn't going to get rid of that.
Go ahead, Claire.
Yeah, I think we can be a lot blunter than that. I think he's afraid that if he doesn't win the next election, he will be indicted for crimes. And
that's the way the system works, right?
And the statute of limitations may have run on those crimes if he is able to get through a second term, right? So he may be quite concrete about his own interests. Now, it seems to me that, of course, if we treat the president as immune to indictment and conviction, then we ought to say that the statute of limitations is told while he's president, right? I personally happen to completely disagree with the idea that a sitting president cannot be indicted. And I think it's important to remember that the Office of Legal Counsel memo that says that is not law.
Right.
It's a piece of guidance to the Justice Department, but it's not law. And I hope that that's one of the things that will be revisited so that presidents don't act with total impunity and think that they can do anything. But the point is that he may be quite concretely thinking about his interests and whether or not he will be indicted for his many crimes.
Just briefly, do you then see this U.S. Supreme Court getting involved in this memo, for instance?
I think it's inevitable. It's inevitable. I did not expect this issue to arise in the context of his tax returns. I'm quite pleased it has, because it's really forcing the country to face the question of, do we want to put our presidents above the law? And do we need that for the sake of having a strong commander-in-chief who protects our national security? I think it's clear that we don't.
Well, I thank all three of you very much for joining us today on Radio Times, giving us a lot to talk about and think about. Claire Finkelstein, as always, thanks for coming in. John Gans, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. And Bruce Gentleson, thank you for joining us from Duke University.
Great. Thanks. I enjoyed it.
Yeah,
thanks
me
so
too
much,
as well. I learned a lot. which is what I like to do on Radio Times. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook, and you can follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.